Budapest University of Technology and Economics, Language Examination Center. This recording is copyright. Intermediate Level Examination, Listening Part 1. You will hear a text. Please read the candidate copy beforehand. You will have 1 minute for that. Then, listen to the text and make notes in English. You will hear the text twice. After the first listening, you will have 1 minute to answer the questions. After the second listening, you will have 2 minutes to finalize your answers. Copy your answers in English on the yellow answer sheet. Now you'll have 1 minute to read the prompts. Now we're ready to start. Listen carefully.
Many banks have unexpectedly gone bankrupt recently. Our reporter, investigating the reasons for this catastrophe, spoke to Mr. Rob Jameson, who recently wrote an article for The New Scientist.
Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Mr. Jameson, what do you think is the quickest way to kill a bank?
As recent events in the financial world have shown, the answer is to deny them access to ready cash. Over the past year, many banking institutions have found themselves in a so-called liquidity crisis. Unable to convince the market they can honour their promises to pay back money they owe. The result has been a series of high-profile failures, from Northern Rock in the UK last year to Lehman Brothers this year.
Did the crisis come without warning?
10 years ago, a giant hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management collapsed when it too suffered a liquidity crisis. Yet banks and regulators seem not to have learnt the lessons from this wake-up call by improving the mathematical models that they use to manage their risk.
How did the risk modelers get it so wrong?
Banks are vulnerable to liquidity crises because they borrow money that may have to be repaid in the short term and use it to back up more lucrative longer-term investments. If depositors withdraw their money and other lenders refuse to lend the bank the funds they need to replace it, the bank ends up in trouble because it can't easily turn its long-term assets into cash to make up the shortfall.
But why didn't they see what was coming?
Liquidity crises, by definition, are rare, extreme events, so all the models you rely on in normal times don't work anymore. What's more, each liquidity crisis is inevitably different from its predecessors, not least because major crises provoke changes in the shape of markets, regulations, and the behaviour of players.
And how could banks have overlooked such massive risks?
Banks wrongly assumed that two areas of vulnerability could be treated in isolation, each with its own risk model. The first set of models covers the bank's day-to-day trading. These models typically assume that market prices will continue to behave much as they have in the past. The second set of risk models is intended to estimate the risk from borrowers failing to repay the money they owe the bank. Because it's harder to sell off loans than bonds or stock, these models assume that the banks may have to bear the risks for longer. This kind of models often use sophisticated mathematics to predict how different debtors might be affected by economic conditions. However, both these models mostly overlook how bad news can affect banks' ability to raise funds.
Now, listen again.
Many banks have unexpectedly gone bankrupt recently. Our reporter, investigating the reasons for this catastrophe, spoke to Mr. Rob Jameson, who recently wrote an article for The New Scientist.
Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Mr. Jameson, what do you think is the quickest way to kill a bank?
As recent events in the financial world have shown, the answer is to deny them access to ready cash. Over the past year, many banking institutions have found themselves in a so-called liquidity crisis. Unable to convince the market they can honour their promises to pay back money they owe. The result has been a series of high-profile failures, from Northern Rock in the UK last year to Lehman Brothers this year.
Did the crisis come without warning?
10 years ago, a giant hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management collapsed when it too suffered a liquidity crisis. Yet banks and regulators seem not to have learnt the lessons from this wake-up call by improving the mathematical models that they use to manage their risk.
How did the risk modellers get it so wrong?
Banks are vulnerable to liquidity crises because they borrow money that may have to be repaid in the short term and use it to back up more lucrative longer-term investments. If depositors withdraw their money and other lenders refuse to lend the bank the funds they need to replace it, the bank ends up in trouble because it can't easily turn its long-term assets into cash to make up the shortfall.
But why didn't they see what was coming?
Liquidity crises, by definition, are rare, extreme events, so all the models you rely on in normal times don't work anymore. What's more, each liquidity crisis is inevitably different from its predecessors, not least because major crises provoke changes in the shape of markets, regulations, and the behaviour of players.
And how could banks have overlooked such massive risks?
Banks wrongly assumed that two areas of vulnerability could be treated in isolation, each with its own risk model. The first set of models covers the bank's day-to-day trading. These models typically assume that market prices will continue to behave much as they have in the past. The second set of risk models is intended to estimate the risk from borrowers failing to repay the money they owe the bank. Because it's harder to sell off loans than bonds or stock, these models assume that the banks may have to bear the risks for longer. This kind of models often use sophisticated mathematics to predict how different debtors might be affected by economic conditions. However, both these models mostly overlook how bad news can affect banks' ability to raise funds.
Now you can copy your answers onto the answer sheet. This is the end of part one. Listening part two. You will now hear a text. Read the 10 statements on the candidate copy beforehand. You will have 1 minute for that. Then please listen to the text. If you think the statement is correct, put a tick under T. If you think the statement is not correct, then put a tick under F. You will hear the text twice. After the first listening, you'll have 1 minute to answer the questions. After the second listening, you'll have 1 minute to finalize your answers. Indicate your answers on the yellow answer sheet. Now you'll have 1 minute to read the statements through. Now we're ready to start. Please listen carefully. Stamps. The head of the stamp department at the Hungarian Post Office is talking about Hungarian stamps. The practice of collecting stamps dates back almost to the birth of the medium in Hungary. Stamps began to be collected in the 1850s, and the first Hungarian catalogue, written in German, appeared in 1886. Collecting stamps used to be a hobby for the privileged few, and was even considered too much like truly eccentric behaviour to be kept a secret. The story goes that there were two collectors living in the same street who only found out about each other's hobby from an American partner with whom they were both corresponding. Collectors later began to form groups and clubs where they could both trade and swap stories. After decline in the hobby's popularity during the First World War, the Association of Hungarian Stamp Collectors was established in 1922. When designing a new stamp, we make sure that it not only has all the requisite information, but that it is also of the highest artistic quality. For example, if we want to portray a painting on a stamp, we don't make a photographic reproduction, but commission a well-known artist to make the illustration. This could be one of the reasons why a fine arts university in the United States is using Hungarian stamps as models for its stamp design courses. The Hungarian Post Office also pays scrupulous attention to its marketing. It produces an annual brochure of new stamps, a three-language almanac of all the stamps issued in that year, and detailed descriptions of both the stamps produced and the artists who designed them. There is also a book series based on the different themes of old Hungarian stamps, for example, Animals on Hungarian Stamps, which is written in Hungarian, German, and English. We are working to get young people interested in stamp collecting. That is why we've started a kids' magazine in 1998 to tell children about stamps and collecting and show them designs made by artists. We're also trying to show people how many different ways stamps can be used, including for charity. When we issued our Animals of the Earth series, every stamp issued was followed up by a charity auction, and the funds raised were donated to the Budapest Zoo. This year, we're including zoos, parks and veterinary clinics in the country when distributing donations. In 1997, we issued half-price stamps and sent the funds to help flood victims in the Czech Republic and Poland. From the many series representing Hungarian heritage and culture, those of the Hungarian wine-producing areas are a unique representation of the characteristic grapes produced in each area. Both this and the Hungarian National Park series have 2 new stamps added each year. Now, listen again. Stamps. The head of the stamp department at the Hungarian Post Office is talking about Hungarian stamps. The practice of collecting stamps dates back almost to the birth of the medium in Hungary. Stamps began to be collected in the 1850s, and the first Hungarian catalogue, written in German, appeared in 1886. Collecting stamps used to be a hobby for the privileged few and was even considered too much like truly eccentric behaviour to be kept a secret. The story goes that there were 2 collectors living in the same street who only found out about each other's hobby from an American partner with whom they were both corresponding. Collectors later began to form groups and clubs where they could both trade and swap stories. After decline in the hobby's popularity during the First World War, the Association of Hungarian Stamp Collectors was established in 1922. When designing a new stamp, we make sure that it not only has all the requisite information, but that it is also of the highest artistic quality. For example, if we want to portray a painting on a stamp, we don't make a photographic reproduction, but commission a well-known artist to make the illustration. This could be one of the reasons why a fine arts university in the United States is using Hungarian stamps as models for its stamp design courses. The Hungarian Post Office also pays scrupulous attention to its marketing. It produces an annual brochure of new stamps, a 3-language almanac of all the stamps issued in that year, and detailed descriptions of both the stamps produced and the artists who designed them. There is also a book series based on the different themes of old Hungarian stamps, for example, Animals on Hungarian Stamps, which is written in Hungarian, German, and English. We are working to get young people interested in stamp collecting. That is why we've started a kids' magazine in 1998 to tell children about stamps and collecting and show them designs made by artists. We're also trying to show people how many different ways stamps can be used, including for charity. When we issued our Animals of the Earth series, every stamp issued was followed up by a charity auction and the funds raised were donated to the Budapest Zoo. This year we're including zoos, parks and veterinary clinics in the country when distributing donations. In 1997, we issued half-price stamps and sent the funds to help flood victims in the Czech Republic and Poland. From the many series representing Hungarian heritage and culture, those of the Hungarian wine-producing areas are a unique representation of the characteristic grapes produced in each area. Both this and the Hungarian National Park series have 2 new stamps added each year. Now you can copy your answers onto the answer sheet. This is the end of the test.